That's the WHO, Eminence Front, which is sort of another way of saying subterfuge, the kind of sleight of hand distractions that were used and described in the book, The Moscow Rules by Tony and Jonna Mendez, secret CIA tactics that helped America win the Cold War. And there are tremendous successes that CIA officials and officers were able to achieve during the period that's outlined in the book. There were also terrible setbacks as well. Americans who betrayed their country and sold out terrible secrets that were very harmful to our country and our national security. We're going to get into examples of both of those in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Jonna Mendez, you had the coolest title that I've ever heard, Chief of Disguise for the CIA. So could you describe a day in the disguise lab or the disguise building? I mean, are you all sharing ideas on how to disguise selves, how to improvise? It's more improvisation, I guess, than always direct planning, right?
You know, no one has ever asked me that question before. A typical day in the disguise labs would be, you'd go in the morning and you'd have someone would go and pick up the cable traffic that comes in from around the world. Comes in overnight. It's sorted. It's organized, and you look to see what the requirements are. What's happening? The things that are in the cables are things that are happening right now. And maybe you have to send somebody. Maybe you have to send them home to get their passport, and someone grabs tickets, and someone else gets an advance of money, and we decide who's going to go, what the job is, what they need to take. And people go out the door. We have people positioned around the world, so they don't always leave from Washington, D.C. It might be someone who's already in Europe or someone who's already in the Far East, whoever can best get to the situation and take care of it. And then we have a schedule every day of people who are routine cases, mostly our case officers getting either they're back from overseas or they're getting ready to go overseas. And they're coming in for what we call disguise programming. That is, we evaluate what we see when they walk in the door. And then we set about defining their requirement. Where are they going to be? How are they going to use a disguise? What's the purpose of the disguise? Who are they trying to fool? How close up is it going to be? For how long? If this is a hot, humid climate, we take that into consideration. And then we start putting together the materials, and it starts at the top of your head and it goes down to your feet. Basic idea is that if you're going to go out and meet with someone, let's assume that the person you're meeting with is going to go back to his office and write a memo describing the person they just met, this American officer maybe. We want every detail in that memo that we can manage. We want it to be wrong. Everything from the color of your hair to if it's short or long, if it's curly or straight, whether you wear glasses or not. What color are your eyes? Do you have facial hair or do you not have facial hair? Do you have a mole on your cheek? Do you have teeth that are problematic, or maybe a gold tooth? Just all the things that we can add or subtract. And we add them and we subtract them. And so we get to a point where you wouldn't fit that memo at all. A point where probably people that know you would not recognize you. I mean, people you work with would not recognize you. The final tests that we give our officers, a lot of the men in particular don't like to wear disguises. So they would usually put up with us. Yes, I'll wear that wig. Yes, I'll glue on that mustache. But we never believed them. So we would have a final fitting. They'd put the whole thing on. Does it feel okay? Is it comfortable? Can you wear this? Yes. Then we'd say, okay, go have lunch in the cafeteria where everyone you know is having lunch at the same time. Just go down there, get your lunch, sit wherever see how it plays. And they would invariably come back after lunch and say, oh, my God, I sat next to my boss at a table next to the guys from my office. And, I mean, you get a rush. There's something very powerful about hiding in plain sight. And they needed to have that experience before they would launch. Otherwise, the disguise is going to sit in a DOP kit in their safe, in their office, and never be used.
And a lot of what you describe is improvisation. I mean, for example, the story that you tell, I think it was your station chief who needed to get out and meet with somebody who ended up dressing as a woman. He's a big, tough guy who ends up dressing as a woman, and you just need a distraction for a minute or so, right?
Oh, that was not just a chief of station. That was Gus Hathaway, who was a legend. We called him at CIA, we called him a baron. He was one of the Soviet East European barons. He was just a larger-than-life guy who didn't have much need or interest in disguise. And he knew that his officers were using disguise for this and that, but he was never a fan. We had a situation where an agent that he had personally recruited and who was working now in Moscow was about to be revealed in a book that was going to be published in the United States. It was a book written by a man named Epstein. And our chief of station knew that when that book was published, that his agent, who was codenamed Fedora, was probably going to be arrested and executed because he was working with the Americans. So our chief of station, Gus Hathaway, was determined that he was going to go out and contact Fedora and warn him and offer him an escape. We were ready to exfiltrate him. Tony Mendez had people on boats going to Sweden to look for a route, to look for a really good route to get him out. Because Hathaway could not get out of the embassy without surveillance pulling in behind him. Two times he went out in a car, and he couldn't meet with the agent because he had surveillance. So he came back, and he said, okay, give me a disguise. And Tony had left a disguise on the shelf with kind of a generic disguise. It was going to fit a lot of people. It was called the Carol disguise. It was made anybody who put on this disguise would look like this woman named Carol who worked there. It was more of a stunt double mask like they use in Hollywood with, you know, when they're making the movies, and they don't want to have the star on the horse fall off the horse and wreck the movie. Stunt double mask. So our chief of station put on the Carol disguise, the mask, the dress. The husband, Carol's husband, was driving the car. The chief of station had Carol's ice skates in his lap. So they had to drive out past the militiaman at the gate. And the militiaman was, of course, KGB. And he was the one who told surveillance, you know, here he comes, get in behind him. But it worked. And they got far enough out of the embassy that he could take that off in the car, got out, went, knocked on the man's door, knocked on Fedora's door, and said, you got to leave. Your name is about to be public. They're going to arrest you. And Fedora said, I guess what Fedora said in Russian was unprintable in English, but something to the effect, screw them, you know, I'm not leaving. I'm gonna stay here and live with dignity like I have my whole life. He was a war hero in Russia. He was a very decorated military man. And he had this confidence that military background would protect him. So, when our chief of station came back to the station, he wrote a memo back to headquarters, and he said, disguise is our most precious technique, and we are going to guard it, and we are going to hold it closely because it's a miracle. And it really helped turn around the perception within the CIA of using disguise, you know, the value that could be had by using a good disguise. It's a great
story. Several stories you tell in the book about, the Moscow rules, the trick is to, you're going to be followed, but to drive around, appear to be driving normally, just get somewhere where you can be out of sight of your pursuers for a couple of seconds, and then deceive them by having either someone else who's wearing the same clothes pop up in the car, or in the case of, at least in some of the cases, blow up dummies. And You tell the story, and there's one line in the book about these young agents who had to get sent out to buy these blow-up dolls a couple of times, and they must have been a little bit embarrassed, but it was necessary.
Yeah, it was an idea that was conceived overseas, that we needed a way to replace a passenger in a car. The passenger would get out, and the dummy would pop up. This is what anyone who drives in an HOV lane in America today would pay a lot of money probably to have one of these dummies in their car, because you could get in an HOV situation. But we started out using something called party dolls, and we bought them in D.C. at this old store down on Pennsylvania Avenue. It was by the White House. It was called Al's Magic Shop, and we sent these young engineers down to buy a half a dozen at a time because they were prototypes, and we were trying to figure out how this was going to work. So initially, they were these plastic dolls, and we inflated them with gas canisters. Well, what started happening is the gas under pressure would come out so fast that it would be so cold that it would, you know, that the dummies would pop up, and then they would explode in the car because they were frozen. It was like glass. It would just shatter. So we had to rework it, and we did rework it. And at the end of the day, it ended up not being a plastic doll. It ended up being a much more elegant solution, the thing on a scissor mechanism that you could put it in a briefcase. You could put it in a woman's purse. You could put it in a backpack, put it in a lot of things, and just set it in the car with the officer who's going to escape. And you would set out from the embassy, and you'd have surveillance behind you. But you would be going to the same place that you always went, say, every Tuesday. So you'd have your surveillance. You would work very hard to have your surveillance relaxed, because it's like, oh, yeah, he always, on Tuesdays, he always stops at that one place. So they'd kind of give you a little extra room. They weren't on your bumper. They were back. And the way that you were going to drive, you needed two right-hand turns in a row. And you do the first right-hand turn, and surveillance is, you're out of sight for about a couple of seconds. You take that second right-hand turn, and now maybe you've got 8 or 9 seconds. That's called a gap. And when you have that much time, it's enough time for the officer in the passenger seat, who has changed his clothes while you're driving, and now he looks like some old Russian retiree with a cane, kind of reeking of vodka and maybe smelling like garlic. He hops out and he's on the street, and the dummy pops up, and it looks exactly like the man who just got out of the car. It's wearing the same clothes that he left the embassy in. It's got a mask that has his face. It's got his same hair. So when surveillance comes around that second corner, they're looking at the car, and there's still two silhouettes in the car. They feel good about that. There's this old guy coming down the street toward them. They're not paying any attention to him because they're intent on following that car. This goes back to the magic idea and the use of twins. This goes back to talking to those fellows out in L.A. This is one way that we used a twinning of a person. So surveillance would follow that car with those two silhouettes in it all afternoon. Our case officer could go, he could put down a dead drop, he could pick up something from the agent, he could put up a signal, he could make a phone call, he could mail a letter, he could do the kinds of things that we were constantly trying to do without surveillance. But then you had to get him back in the car. You had to, what we call, close the loop. So that's a whole separate operational plan for how do you do that. How do you, have to have another scenario, another deception, where when surveillance comes around the corner, that car has stopped somewhere, and the officer who exited earlier is already there. And when the car pulls up and stops, the officer steps out and starts walking away from the car, maybe to go into a store and buy an apple and come out and get in the car and then drive off. And surveillance is perfectly happy. They have nothing to report to their superiors. They followed this car all afternoon. They didn't do anything wrong. They stopped and made some small purchase somewhere, came back. And they never know. Surveillance never knows that they were fooled.
It's so simple. It's clever and simple, but, you know, it's not, it doesn't require a whole bunch of special secret equipment, or it's just, it's subterfuge. It's
it
taking advantage
that,
of the moment.
That duplicate, that dummy, is basically what it requires.
So many of the Moscow rules seem to be instinctive. It's gut reactions. Were they written down before this book,
no,
or is it just something you passed on?
And that's a point that I like to make sure it's clear. We did not write the rules. Tony didn't write the rules. The rules existed out there in the ether. Everybody knew them, but no one had ever written them down. So what Tony did that was so unique, but so Tony, is he wrote them down. He simply wrote them down. I found the other day in his papers, I found where he was sketching them out, where he was, you know, he was mulling them over and saying, no, that's not the right word. And it goes like this. This is the rule. This is what we all understood these things. This is how you had to behave.
You were the chief of disguise, but he was pretty good at it himself. In fact, I remember seeing an interview you gave where you talked about him, Tony versus facial recognition software.
Yeah, it was, you know, facial recognition at CIA, the first time it ever came up was in 1985. Bill Casey had seen the movie Goldfinger, where there's a scene with some terrorist approaching a target and there are cameras on him. And they're able, it's all fake in the Goldfinger movie, but they're able to identify him way before he gets to the target. So Bill Casey said, he called Tony and he said, can we do that? Tony said, not yet. Casey said, are we working on it? Tony said, not yet. And Casey said, well, let's get some people on it. So Tony handed it off to DARPA, the Department of Army. It's the Advanced Research Facility in the Army. And it came back around to us through National Geographic. They did a piece in 1993. It was called Watching You. I'm actually picking it up out of my bookcase right now. They did a two-page spread with thumbnails of Tony Mendez trying to fool the current state of facial recognition with nothing more than a cigar and a hat and, you know, glasses. And Tony could beat what was the current state of the art. He could beat it like 85% of the time just by picking up stuff and putting on stuff. And so it wasn't very good at that point. Then we saw it again at the Spy Museum. University of Maryland was working on one of the contenders. They brought it into the Spy Museum, and it was much, much improved. We were...
I'll tell you what, Jonna, I'm going to have to interrupt this story. We'll come back to that after the break and pick up about how Tony Mendez did against facial recognition software and some of the successes, some of the failures of the CIA during the height of the Cold War. We'll be right back with more of the Moscow Rules in a moment. We're talking with Jonna Mendez about the Moscow Rules, and she details in this book, she and her husband detail how American spies, in particular CIA agents, coaxed or convinced Russians to turn over sensitive information to the U.S. While the CIA was doing that, the Russian KGB and other intelligence services were doing the same, trying to turn Americans, and they had considerable success. Americans who sold out their country and turned over incredibly sensitive information that caused a lot of damage. Why would somebody take those kinds of steps, go to that extreme? CIA has broken it down into four basic categories. We'll talk about that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Jonna, before the break, you were telling us about Tony Mendez, your husband, who was your late husband, who was challenged to see if he could take on facial recognition technology and beat it. Please continue.
Well, it was interesting because National Geographic decided to do a piece called Watching You, the World of High-Tech Surveillance. It was dated 2003, and they were looking at facial recognition at that time. They were looking at what the University of Maryland was presenting. So they took two pictures of Tony. One was maybe 10 years old. One was current. And they had him put on glasses, put on mustaches, baseball caps, that kind of thing, to see if he could beat the system at that time. And he basically could. It was very ambiguous when the systems first started coming out. It was very easy to obscure specific points that facial recognition used at the beginning. The algorithm was not that finely tuned, so that it's looking at the placement of your ears, it's looking the distance from the outer corner of your eye to the outer corner of your mouth. Well, if you put a mustache on, you can obscure the outer corner of your mouth. If you put on a wig or a pair of glasses, or you can obscure that where your ears stop and start, and you can fool that system. But my understanding is today it is really very, very sophisticated. I don't think Tony could beat it again.
And it's everywhere. It's the DMV has it, I guess. The airports have
it. And it's everywhere. Someone told me a story this week. I was just out in San Diego. Someone told me a story about the Chinese, how they have it so refined. This could be an urban legend. I'm not sure, but the story was that they're very specific today in China about jaywalking. You can get ticketed if you're jaywalking, and they're enforcing it. So the story is that a Chinese man did jaywalk. He was picked up by one of the cameras on a light post. His image was taken, and that before he finished crossing the street, his bank account had been debited the amount of the ticket. Isn't that something to think about?
Please share with me what you would consider the greatest success of CIA during this period that's covered in the book. There's several tremendous ones. Which do you think is most important, and how was CIA able to turn that person?
You know, it's interesting that the big successes during the period that's covered by the book, during this Cold War period, came from two different Soviets who we did not even recruit, but each one of them was a volunteer. One was Oleg Penkovsky, and one was Tolkachev. And between the two of them, they helped to change a course of history. Penkovsky volunteered. He was enraged at the Soviet Union, at the government, because of the way that his family had been treated, the way his father had been treated, and the fact that his career was being curtailed. He could never rise any further because of his father's history. So there's nothing like a really angry intelligence officer. He was the man, Oleg Penkovsky was the man who supplied John F. Kennedy with the information during the Cuban Missile Crisis that helped Kennedy confidently make the decision to put that embargo in place, to make the decision not to do anything more rash, because Penkovsky gave Kennedy all the information he needed on those missiles that were being installed in Cuba. He told him how many. He told him where they were. He told him how many more were coming. He told him the state of readiness, told them the throw weight, the distance that they could cover. Kennedy had all the cards, and Khrushchev had nothing to play. And so, of course, Khrushchev backed down. That was one enormous success, because we got so close to a terribly serious situation, like a DEFCON situation. But the other one was a man named Tolkachev, who single-handedly provided the United States government with the 10-year out, the proposed schematics for their new radar systems that would be both airborne and on the ground, both offensive and defensive. It was their next generation of radar. And he provided us he provided the Pentagon with all the information it needed for the Pentagon to take the R&D we were doing and swing it all around and start building the counter technology for this radar that was coming. So that by the time the radar was produced, we already have the countermeasures in place. He was known as the billion-dollar spy. And he was a man who stepped out of the shadows one night and volunteered to work. He wanted to work for the United States for the same reason that Pinkovsky did. His family had been during Stalin's purges, his wife's family had been decimated. The father had been imprisoned. It's just a tragic story of what happened to that family. And Tolkachev, just a little gray man, an engineer who happened to work in a really, really strategic position, decided that he was going to help change the course of history, and he did.
It seems like so many of those stories in your book follow the same pattern. These guys who have their own personal reasons or family reasons for coming forward and offering to help, and I'm yelling at them as I'm reading it, saying, get out of there, because they all end up the same way.
Yeah, Pinkovsky, only the one who gave us the information on the Cuban Missile Crisis, he only lasted 18 months. He was executed. And Tolkachev lasted longer than that, but he was turned in by an American treasonous intelligence officer. Actually, he was turned in by two. He was betrayed twice. Once by Alder James, once by a CIA officer named Howard, who defected to the Soviet Union. And Tolkachev was the first name that he gave them.
You tell the story of at least three of these guys, these American turncoats who provide information.
You know, 1985 was called by Time magazine the year of the spy. There were so many spy cases going on. There were some that were even started that year that Time magazine didn't know about. But a lot of them started coming to fruition, ending. And Edward Reed Howard was one of them. John Walker, who was a naval officer on submarines, who was giving the Russians our cipher codes, who Oleg Kalugin, a KGB general, said if there had been a war, when Walker was working, if there had been a war, America would have lost that war because the Russians would have known where every sub was, where they were going, what they were doing. It was just catastrophic. And then there was Bob Hansen, of course, in the same time period, who was like a human wrecking ball. He gave the Soviet Union everything, not just American technologies, American operations, worldwide operations by our allies. He handed it all to the Soviet Union. And he was operating out of nothing but absolute malice. He was enraged. He was an FBI officer who had not been promoted and thought he should have been, a man who thought he was way better than his colleagues and decided that he would show them that he would become the worst or best spy ever. In the end, when the FBI arrested their colleague, Bob Hansen, who had handed over everything to the Soviet Union, Hansen looks at them and says, "What took you so long? Huh. What took you so long to find me?"
You break it down into four different main categories why people would turn like that. And money is often involved. It's overwhelmingly involved, but it's often, I would think it's not the only primary motivator. I mean, it's something petty like that, or the CIA agent who was sent to Moscow and then sent back home immediately, and he held a grudge.
This thing about ego is a really big part of it. Money plays a large role. Alder James, it was all about money. He was getting divorced. He had a wife that he had to, his first wife, he had to have a settlement with her. Then he had to support this new wife who was very demanding. So he wanted money. He was selling pounds of flesh for dollars, for gold. and he caused about 12 of our foreign agents to be executed. Americans very often were in it for the money. The Soviets were more about ideology, but this idea of ego is huge. And Bob Hansen, it was all about his ego. He felt that he had been underestimated, and he just decided he was going to show them. So he did.
You know, the Cold War, at least that Cold War, is over. And there are those who think that the Russians are now our friends, or at least they're not our adversaries, that that time has passed. I don't want to get too political with it, but as an intelligence officer and somebody who's been up against the KGB and Russian different intelligence services, can you give your assessment of whether they're our pals or not, whether they're to be trusted? Are the dark times over, or are they still underway?
You know, I say the same thing that you just said. I don't like to get too political, because this is a story that we tell is not a political story. And but to respond to your question, our book opens, the first three pages of our book are describing a YouTube video that is probably still up online. I haven't looked recently. It took place in June of 2016. That's the year we were having our presidential election. And it describes the absolute beating of an American diplomat who gets out of a car, gets out of a taxi at about 2 in the morning in Moscow, starts walking toward the door of the American embassy. It's only 20 feet away. He's right there. And this figure comes barreling out of the right-hand side of the frame, jumps him, throws him to the ground, and just starts pounding him. Looks like, I think in the book we call it like a WWE wrestling thing, just a brutal beating. Our American diplomat is on his back on the ground, and he starts pushing and sliding toward the doors of his American embassy. They're very close, and you can watch. I mean, it's kind of painful to watch. Gets close enough, he throws a foot out, and he hits, I don't know, he triggers the door somehow. They're electronic. And they open, and he starts sliding on his back into the American embassy with this Russian on top of him, beating the hell out of him. And now they're in the embassy lobby. They're on American soil, and the Russian does not stop. They medevaced that officer out the next day. He never went back. He had broken bones. His clavicles were broken. I mean, it was brutal. But that was not that long ago. And there have been incidents since then that are well documented. Ambassador McFaul has a book out. He's just reissued it with a new epilogue. But he was in Russia from 2012 to 2014, and he talks about the harassment, the constant harassment, the physicality of it, about people breaking into diplomatic homes. About dogs that would die, about people would walk in and their whole house has been rearranged, about defense attachés driving out of Moscow on approved trips and being buzzed by military helicopters just right over their windshields. It makes you think that, no, it's not over. Maybe it didn't end. Maybe it just went to kind of like a low-grade fever for a while, and now clearly heating up again.
Well, you know, it's a sore spot for a lot of people, the Russian interference in the election. You know, it just seems like the evidence is pretty overwhelming that they were involved and they'll try to do it again. That seems to be a pretty serious matter. Their involvement in other elections and in Europe, that's
you know,
something
this
we
is,
need to...
Yeah. This is, I think, Putin's influence. Putin, who was KGB, Putin, who has a heavy hand like the KGB does, who has a much coarser way of managing affairs, I think his influence is just felt on every level in Moscow, and I think we all see it. And the thing about the elections, I think that is pure Putin. He's a very clever man. He was not a particularly good KGB officer. He did not rise up in the KGB like maybe he wanted to, but he found another way to make a difference.
And, in the same context, intelligence officials who've warned about the Russians become part of the deep state. You're the enemy. That's got to grind on you. If you've been out in the trenches, going toe to toe with the KGB.
Yeah, it's murky. It's very, very murky. And I must say, I'm not in the middle of it anymore. I'm watching closely. I read everything that I can find. I listen to everything that I can find, including your program. And it's getting hard to get your bearings, because it's getting hard to make sure you understand where the ground truth is becoming an issue.
Tell me this: are you at risk still now that you're public? You've given interviews. Your face is known. You've written this stuff. Is there something the Russians would need to learn from you? I mean, it sounds like that attack you're talking about in 2016, the officer who was fighting at the doorway of the embassy, that seemed to be an attempted abduction, not just a beating.
I don't know. What Tony said when he saw that is he said, I think that gentleman broke a rule, and the rule that he broke was don't piss them off. Pardon me, pardon my language, but that's the rule. Don't make them mad. Don't embarrass them. They will come after you. They will bumper lock you if you're in a car. And evidently, they'll come back to your embassy with you and just beat the living daylights out of you. Don't make them mad. That's a rule. It's one of the Moscow rules.
In general, though, they're not shooting you and you're not shooting them.
No. Never has been that way. Never has been that way. We were never... As official representatives of the United States government, we didn't consider ourselves to be in danger. And when the CIA starts working, when we started working against terrorism and against narcotics as targets, well, that's a different set of rules. That's where you do learn to use guns, and that's where you probably want to have a gun handy.
We'll get into that in our next hour here. We have 1 hour left with Jonna Mendez talking about her book, The Moscow Rules, co-written with her late husband, Tony Mendez. We'll be opening up the phone lines here in a moment with your calls and questions.